The corollary is that when they get it, it doesn't work. The restlessness doesn't abate, the pain doesn't go away, the fear comes back as soon as the buzz wears off. 41. The amateur is jealous. Because the amateur is so powerfully identified with herself, she finds it extremely difficult to view the world through the eyes of others. The amateur is often unkind or insensitive to others, but she saves her most exquisite cruelty for herself. The amateur's fear eclipses her compassion for others and for herself. 42. The amateur lacks compassion for himself. In his heart, the amateur knows he's hiding. He knows he was meant for better things. He knows he has turned away from his higher nature. If the amateur had empathy for himself, he could look in the mirror and not hate what he sees. Achieving this compassion is the first powerful step toward moving from being an amateur to being a pro. 43. The amateur seeks permission. The amateur believes that before she can act, she must receive permission from some omnipotent other, a lover or spouse, a parent, a boss, a figure of authority. The amateur sits on a stool, like Lana Turner at Schwab's, waiting to be discovered. 44. The amateur lives for the future. The amateur and the addict focus exclusively on the product and the payoff. Their concern is what's in it for them and how soon and how cheaply they can get it. Consumer culture is designed to exploit the amateur. If you don't believe me, watch 10 minutes of TV or scroll through any magazine or online shopping site. My beef with American culture is that almost every aspect, including the deliberations of the legislature and the judiciary, has been debased to pander to the culture of amateurism. The promise that our products and politicians proffer is the promise one might make to an infant or an addict. I will get you what you want, and it will cost you nothing. 45. The amateur lives in the past. Because the amateur owns nothing of spirit in the present, she either looks forward to a hopeful future or backward to an idyllic past. But the past evoked by the amateur is make-believe. It never existed. It's a highlight reel that she edited together from events that almost took place or should have occurred. In a way, the amateur's reimagined past is worse when it's true, because then it's really gone. The payoff of living in the past or the future is you never have to do your work in the present. 46. The amateur will be ready tomorrow. Two Hollywood producers were talking. I've got good news, said one, and I've got bad news. Give me the good news. Remember that mansion we were trying to rent for the big party scene, but we couldn't get because it cost $50,000 for the night? Well, I just talked to the guy and he'll give it to us for $10,000. What's the bad news? He wants $100 up front. The sure sign of an amateur is that he has a million plans, and they all start tomorrow. 47. The amateur gives his power away to others. Have you ever followed a guru or a mentor? I have. I've given my power away to lovers and spouses. I've sat by the phone. I've waited for permission. I've turned in work and awaited, trembling, the judgment of others. I've given away my power subtly, with a glance that was perceptible to no one, and I've given it away overtly and shamelessly for all the world to see. Exile, failure, and banishment can be good things sometimes because they force us to act from our own center and not from someone else's. I applaud your story of how you hit bottom because at the bottom there's no one there but yourself. 48. The amateur is asleep. The force that can save the amateur is awareness, particularly self-awareness. But the amateur understands, however dimly, that if she truly achieved this knowledge, she would be compelled to act upon it. To act upon this self-awareness would mean defining herself, i.e. differentiating herself from the tribe, and thus making herself vulnerable to rejection, expulsion, and all the other fears that self-definition elicits. Fear of self-definition is what keeps an amateur, and what keeps an addict. 49. The tribe doesn't give a shit. The amateur dreads becoming who she really is because she fears that this new person will be judged by others as different. The tribe will declare us weird or queer or crazy. The tribe will reject us. Here's the truth. The tribe doesn't give a shit. There is no tribe. That gang or posse that we imagine is sustaining us by the bonds we share is in fact a conglomeration of individuals who are just as fucked up as we are and just as terrified. Each individual is so caught up in his own bullshit that he doesn't have 2 seconds to worry about yours or mine or to reject or diminish us because of it. When we truly understand that the tribe doesn't give a shit, we're free. There is no tribe, and there never was. Our lives are entirely up to us. 50. Part-time pros. Sometimes we can be professionals in our shadow careers, but amateurs in our true calling. How many creative directors at ad agencies have unfinished novels and screenplays sitting in their office drawers? How many lawyers and doctors do you know who would make sensational essayists or novelists or historians, but beyond the odd op-ed submission, never propel themselves past literary first base? I know producers who yearn to be directors, moms who are itching to launch startups, grad students who could solve climate change. Sometimes the reason we choose these careers, consciously or unconsciously, is to produce incapacity. Resistance is diabolical. It can harness our drive for greatness and our instinct for professionalism and yoke them instead to a shadow profession whose demands will keep us from turning our energies toward their true course. Sometimes it's easier to be a professional in a shadow career than it is to turn pro in our real calling. Now, let's talk about turning pro. 51. Life gets very simple when you turn pro. What happens when we turn pro is we finally listen to that still small voice inside our heads. At last, we find the courage to identify the secret dream or love or bliss that we have known all along was our passion, our calling, our destiny. Ballet, motorcycle maintenance, founding a clinic in the slums of Sao Paulo. This, we acknowledge at last, is what we are most afraid of. This is what we know in our hearts we have to do. 52. How your life changes when you turn pro. I said in The War of Art that I could divide my life neatly into 2 sections, before I turn pro and after. This is absolutely true. I didn't change after I turned pro. I did not achieve enlightenment. I'm the same person I always was, with the same weaknesses and the same fallibilities. But everything is different since I turned pro. Before we turn pro, our life is dominated by fear and resistance. We live in a state of denial. We're denying the voice in our heads. We're denying our calling. We're denying who we really are. We're fleeing from our fear into an addiction or a shadow career. What changes when we turn pro is we stop fleeing. "Be brave, my heart," wrote the poet and mercenary Archilochus. "Plant your feet and square your shoulders to the enemy. Meet him among the men killing spears. Hold your ground." When we turn pro, we stop running from our fears. We turn around and face them. 53. How your day changes when you turn pro. When we turn pro, everything becomes simple. Our aim centers on the ordering of our days in such a way that we overcome the fears that have paralyzed us in the past. We now structure our hours not to flee from fear, but to confront it and overcome it. We plan our activities in order to accomplish an aim, and we bring our will to bear so that we stick to this resolution. This changes our days completely. It changes what time we get up, and it changes what time we go to bed. It changes what we do and what we don't do. It changes the activities we engage in and with what attitude we engage in them. It changes what we read and what we eat. It changes the shape of our bodies. When we were amateurs, our life was about drama, about denial, and about distraction. Our days were simultaneously full to the bursting point and achingly, heartbreakingly empty. But we are not amateurs anymore. We are different, and everyone in our lives sees it. 54. How people change when you turn pro. Turning pro changes how we spend our time and with whom we spend it. It changes our friends, it changes our spouses and children. It changes who is drawn to us and who is repelled by us. Turning pro changes how people perceive us. Those who are still fleeing from their own fears will now try to sabotage us. They will tell us we've changed and try to undermine our efforts at further change. They will attempt to make us feel guilty for these changes. They will try to entice us to get stoned with them or fuck off with them or waste time with them, as we've done in the past, and when we refuse, they will turn against us and talk us down behind our backs. At the same time, new people will appear in our lives. They will be people who are facing their own fears and who are conquering them. These people will become our new friends. When we turn pro, we will be compelled to make painful decisions. There will be people who in the past had been colleagues and associates, even friends, whom we will no longer be able to spend time with if our intention is to grow and to evolve. We will have to choose between the life we want for our future and the life we have left behind. 55. How your mind changes when you turn pro. Turning pro is like kicking a drug habit or stopping drinking. It's a decision to which we must recommit every day. 12-step programs say, one day at a time. The professional says the same thing. Each day, the professional understands, he will wake up facing the same demons, the same resistance, the same self-sabotage, the same tendencies to shadow activities and amateurism that he has always faced. The difference is that now he will not yield to those temptations. He will have mastered them, and he will continue to master them. 56. What makes us turn pro? Turning pro is a decision, but it's such a monumental life-overturning decision, and one that is usually made only in the face of overwhelming fear, that the moment is frequently accompanied by powerful drama and emotion. Often it's something we've been avoiding for years, something we would never willingly face unless overwhelming events compelled us to. Turning pro is like Pearl Harbor or 9/11 or the assassination of President Kennedy. We never forget where we were when it happened. Here are two turning pro moments, both from female friends. 57. Ms. X in Bakersfield. Ms. X is an attorney who lives in Los Angeles. Here's her story. I was driving alone from San Francisco to L.A. I took Interstate 5 because it was faster than the 101 and I had a meeting I had to get to. I got to Bakersfield around 5 and pulled off to find a gas station. I woke up the next morning in a motel room, by myself, in the same clothes I had been wearing the night before, with an empty quart of Jim Beam on the bedstand beside me. Why that time was different from any of 100 times before, I don't know. But as I was staring at my reflection in the bathroom mirror, I heard my own voice say, "That's enough, darling. This shit has got to stop." 58. Roseanne Cash's Dream. The following is an excerpt from Roseanne Cash's memoir, Composed. Thanks, Rose, for sharing it. A note here, Kings, in the first sentence, refers to King's Record Shop, the 1987 album that produced 4 number one singles. It was late in the making of Kings that I had a dream that changed my life. I had met Linda Ronstadt a few times, in Los Angeles while I was recording at Lania Lane, when I opened for Bonnie Raitt at the Greek Theater and Linda had come to see the show, and on a number of other occasions as we traveled in the same circles and worked with many of the same musicians. Her record, Heart Like a Wheel, had profoundly affected me as a young girl, and I had studied it assiduously as a great example of a feminine point of view concept record, the best one since Joni Mitchell's Blue, I thought, and equally important in the template I was creating for what I might do in my life. I especially admired her thoughtful song selection, which resulted in a very well-balanced album, and I wanted to make a record with a similarly unified concept, but as a songwriter. Just as I was beginning to record Kings, I had read an interview with her in which she said that in committing to artistic growth, you had to, quote, refine your skills to support your instincts, unquote. This made such a deep impression on me that I clipped the article to save it. A short time after that, I dreamed I was at a party, sitting on a sofa with Linda and an elderly man who was between us. His name, I somehow knew, was Art. He and Linda were talking animatedly, deeply engrossed in their conversation. I tried to enter the discussion and made a comment to the old man. He turned his head slowly from Linda to me and looked me up and down with obvious disdain and an undisguised lack of interest. "We don't respect dilettantes," he spat out, and turned back to Linda. I felt utterly humiliated and woke from this dream shaken to the core. I had been growing uneasy in my role in the Nashville community and the music business as a whole. I thought of myself primarily as a songwriter, but I had written only 3 songs on Kings. I was famous and successful, but it felt hollow, and the falsehoods were piling up. With more success had come more pressure to be a certain way, to toe a certain line, to start a fan club, which I refused to do, to participate in big, splashy events, and to act as if the country music scene were a religion to which I belonged. I resisted the push to conform, to buy into a certain narrow aesthetic, and to become part of an established hierarchy. I didn't want a lofty perch. I wanted to be in the trenches where the inspiration was. My unease led me to that dream. Carl Jung said that a person might have 5 big dreams in her life, dreams that provoke a shift in consciousness, and this was my first. From that moment, I changed the way I approached songwriting. I changed how I sang, I changed my work ethic, and I changed my life. The strong desire to become a better songwriter dovetailed perfectly with my budding friendship with John Stewart, who had written Runaway Train for King's Record Shop. John encouraged me to expand the subject matter of my songs, as well as my choice of language and my mind. I played new songs for him, and if he thought it was too perfect, which was anathema to him, he would say over and over, "But where's the madness, Rose?" I started looking for the madness. I sought out Marge Rivingston in New York to work on my voice, and I started training as if I were a runner in both technique and stamina. Oddly, it turned out that Marge also worked with Linda, which I didn't know when I sought her out. I started paying attention to everything, both in the studio and out. If I found myself drifting off into daydreams, an old entrenched habit, I pulled myself awake and back into the present moment. Instead of toying with ideas, I examined them, and I tested the authenticity of my instincts musically. I stretched my attention span consciously. I read books on writing by Natalie Goldberg and Carolyn Heilbrunn, and began to self-edit and refine more, and went deeper into every process involved with writing and musicianship. I realized I had earlier been working only within my known range, never pushing far outside the comfort zone to take any real risks. I started painting, so I could learn about the absence of words and sound and why I needed them. I took painting lessons from Sharon Orr, who had a series of classes at a studio called Art and Soul. I remained completely humbled by the dream, and it stayed with me through every waking hour of completing King's Record Shop. I vowed the next record would reflect my new commitment. Rodney Crowell, my then husband, was at the top of his game as a record producer, but I had come to feel curiously like a neophyte in the studio after the dream. Everything seemed new, frightening, and tremendously exciting. I had awakened from the morphine sleep of success into the life of an artist. 59. My own moment of turning pro. The following is from a chapter called Resistance and Healing in the War of Art. I washed up in New York a couple of decades ago, making $20 a night driving a cab and running away full-time from doing my work. One night, alone in my $110 a month sublet, I hit bottom in terms of having diverted myself into so many phony channels so many times that I couldn't rationalize it for one more evening. I dragged out my ancient Smith Corona, dreading the experience as pointless, fruitless, meaningless, not to say the most painful exercise I could think of. For 2 hours, I made myself sit there, torturing out some trash that I chucked immediately into the shit can. That was enough. I put the machine away. I went back to the kitchen. In the sink sat 10 days of dishes. For some reason, I had enough excess energy that I decided to wash them. The warm water felt pretty good. The soap and sponge were doing their thing. A pile of clean plates began rising in the drying rack. To my amazement, I realized that I was whistling. It hit me that I had turned a corner. I was okay. I would be okay from here on. Do you understand? I hadn't written anything good. It might be years before I would if I ever did at all. That didn't matter. What counted was that I had, after years of running from it, actually sat down and done my work. 60. The Nature of Epiphanies. We usually think of breakthroughs as ecstatic moments that elevate us from a lower level to a higher, and they do. But there's a paradox. In the moment, an epiphany feels like hell. Like Roseanne Cash's dream, an epiphany trashes us. It exposes us and leaves us naked. We see ourselves plain, and it's not a pretty picture. The essence of epiphanies is the stripping away of self-delusion. We thought we were X. Now suddenly we see we're minus X. We're X divided by infinity. There's great power in this moment. We've lost something, yes. A cherished self-delusion must be abandoned, and this hurts. But what we have gained is the truth. Our bullshit falls away. The scales drop from our eyes. In that moment, we have two options. We can reconstitute our bullshit, or we can turn pro. 61. Shame is good. In the post-epiphanal moment, we have two things going for us that we didn't have 90 seconds earlier. We have reality, and we have humility. These are powerful allies. And we have a third force working in our favor, shame. Why is shame good? Because shame can produce the final element we need to change our lives, will. Epiphanies hurt. There's no glory to them. They only make good stories at AA meetings or late at night among other foot soldiers in the trenches. These soldiers know. Each has his own story of that ghastly, hideous, excruciating moment when it all turned around for him. Book 3, The Professional Mindset. 62, Qualities of the Professional. In The War of Art, I listed the following as habits and qualities that the professional possesses that the amateur doesn't. 1, the professional shows up every day. 2, the professional stays on the job all day. 3, the professional is committed over the long haul. 4, for the professional, the stakes are high and real. Further, the professional is patient. The professional seeks order. The professional demystifies. The professional acts in the face of fear. The professional accepts no excuses. The professional plays it as it lays. The professional is prepared. The professional does not show off. The professional dedicates himself to mastering technique. The professional does not hesitate to ask for help. The professional does not take failure or success personally. The professional does not identify with his or her instrument. The professional endures adversity. The professional self-validates. The professional reinvents herself. The professional is recognized by other professionals. Here are a few additional qualities before we move on to the higher expression of professionalism. 63. A professional is courageous. The professional displays courage not only in the roles she embraces, which inevitably scare the hell out of her, or the sacrifices she makes of time, love, family, or even in the enduring of criticism, blame, envy, and lack of understanding, but above all in the confronting of her own doubts and demons. The linebacker and the Army Ranger go into action as part of a team, but the artist and the entrepreneur enter combat alone. I take my hat off to every man or woman who does this. 64. The professional will not be distracted. The amateur tweets, the pro works. 65. The professional is ruthless with himself. Picasso was in his Paris studio, this is a true story, with the owner of the gallery where his paintings were displayed and sold. The Spaniard was showing off his latest series of portraits, which he had labored for months to produce. The gallery owner was ecstatic. He couldn't wait to get these brilliant new works into the gallery and start selling them. Suddenly, Picasso seized a palette knife and strode to the first painting. To the gallery owner's horror, Picasso slashed the canvas from end to end. Pablo, Arret, Pablito! But Picasso didn't stop. Blade in hand, he marched down the line of paintings, reducing each one to ribbons. The professional knows when he has fallen short of his own standards. He will murder his darlings without hesitation, if that's what it takes to stay true to the goddess and to his own expectations of excellence. 66. The professional has compassion for herself. I got the chance a few years ago to watch a famous trainer work with his thoroughbreds. I had imagined that the process would be something hardcore like Navy SEAL training. To my surprise, the sessions were more like play. The work was serious, as in teaching the two-year-olds to enter the starting gate, and the horses were definitely learning, but the trainer took pains to make the schooling feel like fun. When a horse got tired, the trainer took him off the track. If a mount got bored or restive, the trainer never forced him to continue or drove him, quote-unquote, through the pain. He explained, "A horse is a flight animal. Even a stallion, if he can, will choose flight over confrontation. Picture the most sensitive person you've ever known. A horse is 10 times more sensitive. A horse is a naked nervous system, particularly a thoroughbred. He's a child. A 3-year-old, big and fast as he is a baby. Horses understand the whip, but I don't want a racer that runs that way. A horse that loves to run will beat a horse that's compelled every day of the week. I want my horses to love the track. I want my exercise riders to have to hold them back in the morning because they're so excited to get out there and run. Never train your horse to exhaustion. Leave him wanting more." 67. The professional lives in the present. The amateur spends his time in the past and the future. He permits himself to fear and to hope. The professional has taught himself to banish these distractions. When Stephen Sondheim makes a hat, he is thinking of nothing else. He is immersed. He loses himself in the work and in the moment. 68. The professional defers gratification. I'm guilty of checking my email. Are you? We're crazy. What do we imagine we're going to find in our inbox? The children who are able to sit for 3 minutes with a marshmallow on the table in front of them without eating it were rewarded with 2 marshmallows when the experimenter returned. But that's as crazy as inbox watching. Krishna said, "We have the right to our labor, but not to the fruits of our labor." He meant that the piano is its own reward, as is the canvas, the bar, and the moviola. Fuck the marshmallows. 69. The professional does not wait for inspiration. We're all nothing without the muse. But the pro has learned that the goddess prizes labor and dedication beyond any theatrical seeking of her favors. The professional does not wait for inspiration. He acts in anticipation of it. He knows that when the muse sees his butt in the chair, she will deliver. 70. The professional does not give his power away to others. The dictionary defines icon as an article, a relic, say, that once belonged to a saint or a holy man, that serves as an object of worship. A person can be an icon. When we make someone into an icon, we give away our power. We say to ourselves unconsciously, this person possesses qualities I wish I possessed. Therefore, I will worship this person in the hope that that quality will wear off on me, or I will acquire that quality by virtue of my proximity to this mentor, sensei, lover, teacher, hero. In my experience, when we project a quality or virtue onto another human being, we ourselves almost always already possess that quality, but we're afraid to embrace and to live that truth. The amateur is an acolyte, a groupie. The professional may seek instruction or wisdom from one who is further along in mastery than he, but he does so without surrendering his self-sovereignty. 71. The professional helps others. When I first finished the manuscript for Gates of Fire, it was 800 pages long. My agent, Sterling Lord, though he loved it, said he couldn't submit it to publishers unless I cut at least 300 pages. That was like telling me to amputate not one limb, but two. I was devastated. One of the people Sterling had shown the manuscript to was Tom Ginsberg, who had been head of Viking Press for years. It was a hell of a thing for someone of Tom's stature simply to glance at an unknown writer's work. But Tom did more. He sent me a note. I still have it. The central sentence said, "There's something great in here, Steve. I have confidence that you will find it and bring it out." I barely knew Tom and he barely knew me, but if you saw the thumbprints I put on that note from the dozens of times I picked it up and hung onto its words for inspiration, you would think we were the best of buds from way back. The amateur hoards his knowledge and his reinforcement. He believes if he shares what he possesses with others, he will lose it. The professional is happy to teach. He will gladly lend a hand or deliver a swift kick. But there's a caveat. The professional refuses to be iconized. Not for selfish reasons, but because he knows how destructive the dynamic of iconization is to the iconizer. The pro will share his wisdom with other professionals or with amateurs who are committed to becoming professionals. Like Art in Roseanne Cash's dream, he will not waste his time on dilettantes. 72. What about the magic? The professional mindset works in two ways. It's important for us to grasp the distinction. First, the pro mindset is a discipline that we use to overcome resistance, to defeat the self-sabotaging habits of procrastination, self-doubt, susceptibility to distraction, perfectionism, and shallowness. We enlist the self-strengthening habits of order, regularity, discipline, and a constant striving after excellence. That's not hard to understand. But what about the magic? What about madness? What about flashes of brilliance and uncontrollable outbursts of genius? How does the professional mindset help there? Isn't it too severe, too hardcore, too regimented? Answer, no. The monk glimpses the face of God, not by scaling a peak in the Himalayas, but by sitting still in silence. Yoga, meditation, and the martial arts access the soul by way of the body. The physical leads to the spiritual. The humble produces the sublime. It seems counterintuitive, but it's true. In order to achieve quote-unquote flow, magic, the zone, we start by being common and ordinary and workmanlike. We set our palms against the stones in the garden wall and search, 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 until at last, in the instant when we're ready to give up, our fingers fasten upon the secret door. Like a child entering a meadow, We step over the threshold, forgetting everything except the butterfly that flits across our vision. From this play arises Guernica and The Godfather and the Guggenheim Museum Bilbao. 73. A Marine Gets Two Salaries. There's a well-known gunnery sergeant who, when his young Marines complain about their pay, explains that they get two salaries, a financial salary and a psychological salary. The financial salary is indeed meager. But what about the psychological salary? The feeling of pride and honor, the sense of belonging to a brotherhood with a brave and noble history, and knowing that no matter what happens, you remain a member of that fraternity as long as you live? How much, the gunny asks, is that worth? You and I, as artists and entrepreneurs, receive two salaries as well. The first might be called conventional rewards. Money, applause, attention. That kind is fine if we can get it. The problem for most of us is we can't. We bust our butts training and practicing and studying and rehearsing, and nobody shows up, nobody notices, nobody even knows we exist. No wonder people quit. The struggle requires too much agony for too little payoff. That's the conventional reward. Then there's the psychological reward. Remember, Krishna told Arjuna that he had the right to his labor, but not to the fruits of his labor. What he meant was conventional fruits. Does the monk meditate only to achieve enlightenment? What if that never happens? What does the dancer take from ballet class? Is it fun for the actor to perform? Why does the singer sing or the filmmaker shoot? When we do the work for itself alone, and I know how easy that is to say and how hard it is to do, we're like that Marine who sleeps in a foxhole in the freezing rain, but who knows a secret that only he and his brothers and sisters share. When we do the work for itself alone, our pursuit of a career or living or fame or wealth or notoriety turns into something else, something loftier and nobler, which we may never even have thought about or aspired to at the beginning. It turns into a practice. 74. My Years in the Wilderness. In a way, I was lucky that I experienced failure for so many years. Because there were no conventional rewards, I was forced to ask myself, why am I doing this? Am I crazy? All my friends are making money and settling down and living normal lives. What the hell am I doing? Am I nuts? What's wrong with me? In the end, I answered the question by realizing that I had no choice. I couldn't do anything else. When I tried, I got so depressed I couldn't stand it. So when I wrote yet another novel or screenplay that I couldn't sell, I had no choice but to write another after that. The truth was I was enjoying myself. Maybe nobody else liked the stuff I was doing, but I did. I was learning. I was getting better. The work became, in its own demented way, a practice. It sustained me, and it sustains me still. 75. The Professional Mindset as a Practice. What is a practice anyway? To quote, have a practice, unquote, in yoga, say, or tai chi or calligraphy, is to follow a rigorous, prescribed regimen with the intention of elevating the mind and the spirit to a higher level. A practice implies engagement in a ritual. A practice may be defined as the dedicated daily exercise of commitment, will, and focused attention aimed on one level at the achievement of mastery in a field, but on a loftier level, intended to produce a communion with a power greater than ourselves. Call it whatever you like. God, mind, soul, self, the muse, the superconscious. The following are aspects of any practice. 76. A practice has a space. A practice has a space, and that space is sacred. There's a wonderful book called Where Women Create. It's a compilation of photos of studios and workshops where various female artists do their magic. The workspaces are those of potters and weavers, quilters and dressmakers, architects and sculptors, painters, filmmakers, editors. The book has an excellent text, but you don't need to read it. Just look at these sacred spaces. What you'll see is this: order, commitment, passion, love, intensity, beauty, humility. 26 artists with 26 different personal odysseys. Many, no doubt, include divorce, heartbreak, alcoholism, you name it. But every woman in this book has, in her artistic life, transcended these impediments, and every one has arrived at the same space. They all serve the muse, and each has discovered in that service her unique and authentic essence. 77. A practice has a time. The monks in their saffron robes mount the steps to the zendo at the same hour each morning. When the abbot strikes the chime, the monks place their palms together and sit. You and I may have to operate in a more chaotic universe, but the object remains the same: to approach the mystery via order, commitment, and passionate intention. When we convene day upon day in the same space at the same time, a powerful energy builds up around us. This is the energy of our intention, of our dedication, of our commitment. The goddess sees this energy, and she rewards it. 78. A practice has an intention. When Stevie Wonder sits down in the studio at the piano, he's not there to mess around. Stevie has come to work. The 10,000-hour rule, made famous by Malcolm Gladwell in Outliers, postulates that the achievement of mastery in any field, be it brain surgery or throwing a split-finger fastball, requires approximately 10,000 hours of practice. But the key, according to Mr. Gladwell, is that that practice be focused. It must possess intention. Our intention as artists is to get better, to go deeper, to work closer and closer to the bone. 79. We come to a practice as warriors. The sword master stepping onto the fighting floor knows he will be facing powerful opponents. Not the physical adversaries whom he will fight, though those indeed serve as stand-ins for the enemy. The real enemy is inside himself. The monk in meditation knows this. So does the yogi. So do the film editor and the video game creator and the software writer. Each day we as professionals face the same monsters and dragons as did Perseus or Bellerophon or St. George. The swordmaster advancing into ritual combat has inwardly made peace with his own extinction. He is prepared to leave everything, including his life, there on the fighting floor. 80. We come to a practice in humility. We may bring intention and intensity to our practice. In fact, we must. But not ego. Dedication, even ferocity, yes, but never arrogance. The space of the practice is sacred. It belongs to the goddess. We take our shoes off before we enter. We press our palms together and we bow. Do you understand how the mystery can be approached via order? 81. We come to a practice as students. Even the peerless swordmaster Miyamoto Musashi entered the fighting square to learn as much as to teach. 82. A practice is lifelong. The Spartan king Agesilaus was still fighting in armor when he was 82. Picasso was painting past 90, and Henry Miller was chasing women. I'm sure Picasso was too, at 89. Once we turn pro, we're like sharks who have tasted blood or renunciants who have glimpsed the face of God. For us, there is no finish line. No bell ends the bout. Life is the pursuit. Life is the hunt. When our hearts burst, then we'll go out, and no sooner. 83. Roseanne Cash's Dream, Part 2. The specific details of acquiring professionalism evolve naturally. They're self-evident. When Roseanne Cash had her dream, she got the message. The epiphany is everything. When we see the gaping holes in our practice, or discover that we have no practice at all, no one has to school us in time management or resource allocation. We know what we have to do. The other thing about the changes Roseanne made after her dream is that she didn't make those changes to earn more money or to achieve greater fame or to sell more records. She made those changes out of respect for her craft. She made them to become a better artist and a more powerful musician. When we elevate our game aesthetically, we elevate it morally and spiritually as well. 84. The professional trusts the mystery. Patricia Ryan Madsen taught improv at Stanford for years to standing room only classes. Her book, Improv Wisdom, is on my short list of indispensables. Patricia has an exercise that she calls, What's in the Box? She asks her students to imagine a small white box. Imagine a lid on this box. Now lift the lid. What do you find inside? Sometimes students say a diamond, sometimes a frog, sometimes a pomegranate. The trick is, there's always something inside the box. With this exercise, Patricia was addressing her students' seminal terror that they would get up on stage and draw a blank. The professional trusts the mystery. He knows that the muse always delivers. She may surprise us, she may give us something we never expected, but she will always put something inside the box. The following are five axioms derived from this principle that I work by every day. 85. Work over your head. Writers of fiction learn early that it is possible to write a character who is smarter than they are. How can that be? The answer lies in the mystery. That place that we write from, or paint from, or compose from, or innovate from, is far deeper than our petty personal egos. That place is beyond intellect. It is deeper than rational thought. It is instinct. It is intuition. It is imagination. If you and I cast Meryl Streep as Queen Boudica in our next Hollywood blockbuster, will we have any doubt that she can pull it off, even though she has never heard of and knows nothing about Queen Boudica? Miss Streep will go wherever it is that she goes, and she'll come back with Queen Boudica. She will have become Queen Boudica. You and I can do it too. We can work over our heads. Not only can we, but we must. The best pages I've ever written are pages I can't remember writing. 86. Write what you don't know. Years ago in New York, I had hit the wall as a failed novelist. My next day's to-do list had been reduced to two options. Kill myself by hanging, kill myself by jumping off the roof. Instead, I decided to write a screenplay. The story I wrote was about prison. I have never been to prison. I didn't know the first thing about prison. But I was so desperate that I plunged in, slinging bullshit with both hands and not looking back. When I was done, I showed the script to a few writers I knew. More than one tugged me aside and asked in a whisper, Steve, where did you do time? Good things happen when we trust the mystery. There is always something in the box. 87. Take what the defense gives you. Every book I write has at least one giant section that's as tough as a knot in a plank of lumber. I can't crack it head on. Attacking from the flank doesn't work. The damn thing is just too stubborn. When you're up against that kind of resistance, there's no shame in taking what the defense will give you. In football terms, we shut that part of the playbook that contains the deep go routes and the 55-yard bombs. We turn instead to that section that has the short slants and the 3-yard dinks into the flat. Two key tenets for days when resistance is really strong. One, take what you can get and stay patient. The defense may crack late in the game. Two, play for tomorrow. Our role on tough nut days is to maintain our composure and keep chipping away. We're pros. We're not amateurs. We have patience. We can handle adversity. Tomorrow the defense will give us more, and tomorrow we'll take it. There's a third tenet that underlies the first two. 3. We're in this for the long haul. Our work is a practice. One bad day is nothing to us. 10 bad days are nothing. In the scheme of our lifelong practice, 24 hours when we can't gain yardage is only a speed bump. We'll forget it by breakfast tomorrow and be back again ready to hurl our bodies into the fray. 88. Play hurt. The amateur believes that she must have all her ducks in a row before she can launch her startup or compose her symphony or design her iPhone app. The professional knows better. Has your husband just walked out on you? Has your Eldorado been repossessed? Keep writing. Keep composing. Keep shooting film. Athletes play hurt. Warriors fight scared. The professional takes 2 aspirin and keeps on trucking. 89. Sit chilly. Sue Sally Hale was a famous equestrian and teacher of horsemanship. She had a phrase that she drilled into her students' heads, sit chilly. If you and I are riding in a steeplechase, we may find ourselves at the gallop atop our 1,000-pound or 1,200-pound hunter jumper approaching a stone wall that looks like it's about 15 feet high. Dire thoughts may enter our heads at that point. Trickier still, the rider's seat, meaning the way we sit in the saddle, is how our intentions are communicated to the ultra-sensitive mount beneath us. If fear and uncertainty enter our minds, the horse will know instantly. At that point, anything can happen. Sue Sally said, sit chilly. She meant not just be cool or stay composed. She meant maintain your seat. The professional knows that in the course of her pursuit, she will inevitably experience moments of terror, even panic. She knows she can't choke that panic back or wish it away. It's there and it's for real. The pro sits chilly. She focuses on the horse and the wall. She keeps her seat. 90. The professional and the primitive. A couple of years ago, I got the chance to travel to Africa. Among the places I visited was a Maasai camp. The site was so far out in the boonies that we had to fly to it. There were no roads. We had 2 city Maasai with us, a young man and a young woman, who did the translating. When we landed, a commotion was going on. Our guides explained to us, after speaking with several of the camp elders, that the shaman had just determined that the place the village had made camp in was unwholesome, so everyone was packing up to move. The population of the camp was about 500, warriors, kids, old folks, plus all the tribe's livestock. The ceremony of moving camp required that the procession be led by the white cattle, so these were being rounded up. This was no simple operation, as the individual cows were owned by different families and were scattered all over the valley. We watched for more than an hour while the elders, under the direction of the shaman, collected the white cattle and herded them to the front of the procession. The whole tribe had packed up now. The warriors, the tall, slim morans, were singing a ritual song and jumping up and down, surrounded by the pretty young maidens, contributing their own chorus. Finally, the village moved. About 200 yards up the hill. "That's it?" one of the visitors asked. We were watching the shaman. Yep, that was it. He had solved the problem. The new campsite was much better. At the time, I didn't think much about this. It all seemed perfectly natural and in keeping with Africa and tribal life. But when I got home, I began to wonder about the assumptions, as imperfectly as I could grasp them, that underpinned this whole extravaganza. 1. Some invisible force threatened the camp. Ghosts? Restive ancestors? Free-floating evil? Would wicked things befall the tribespeople if they remained in the first camp? 2. This invisible evil could be warded off by moving the camp, even though that move was only a few hundred feet. How did that make sense? Couldn't the evil force simply follow the tribe up the hill and work its malice in the new camp? Why did such a simple fix solve the problem? 3. One individual, a shaman, was capable of perceiving this evil force, of divining its malign intent, and of remedying this by a specific course of action. 4. The tribe followed the shaman's instructions without a murmur of protest. No matriarch complained about having to pack up her stuff, which for each family was considerable and which involved a serious amount of labor and sweat. No warrior protested. One and all, the people fell into line and participated freely and cheerfully. In fact, I must observe of myself that I too accepted the shaman's wisdom. When we got uphill to the new camp, I confess it felt better. I was glad we had moved. 5. Lastly, I considered the Maasai culture itself. These were no benighted savages being exploited by some canny hoodoo man. The Maasai were and are one of the great warrior cultures of all time. They have been in East Africa since the 1500s, longer than the existence of the U.S. of A., and they've thrived and dominated in a harsh land peopled by proud, strong, and aggressive tribal adversaries. Beyond that, the culture of the Maasai is brilliant. Their dress, their rituals, their social organization, they are tall, strong, and beautiful. Their young men stand up to lions single-handedly and slay the beasts with only a spear. They must be doing something right. What if, I ask myself, the Maasai view of the world is correct? What if there really was an evil force threatening the lower camp? What if the shaman really saw it and concocted exactly the right remedy? Maybe if we had stayed in the lower camp, one of the pregnant young wives would have miscarried. Maybe a fight would have broken out between two braves and one of them would have hurt the other. Maybe the whole village would have been seized by collective evil. What does all this have to do with the professional and the idea of turning pro? Here's what I think. My worldview is pretty much that of the Maasai. I believe in the shaman. I wish I had a shaman. If I had a shaman, I would have breakfast with him every morning, and whatever he told me to do that day, I would do it. Better yet, I wish I was a shaman. In truth, I practice my own form of shamanism every day. As an artist, I seek to access unseen powers. Evil forces are out there. Resistance, self-doubt, self-sabotage. How many other malign entities are hovering each morning over me and my huevos rancheros? Then there are the good forces. Inspiration, enthusiasm, courage, new ideas, brilliant breakthroughs, insights, intuitions. Where do these come from? I don't know. How can I access them? I have no clue. Yet this is my business. This is my life. Damn right I want that shaman. He is my man. I love the guy. In lieu of the shaman, I have what? I have a code of professionalism. I have virtues that I seek to strengthen and vices that I labor to eradicate. I serve the goddess. Where she tells me to go, I go. I wish I knew that shaman. I would love to sit down with him. I'd ask him what he saw that morning. How did he see it? What course of initiation had he undergone to acquire his knowledge? Does he serve the gods like I do? Does he regard his gifts as a blessing or a curse? 91. A Model of the Universe. I was having breakfast with my friend Rabbi Mordecai Finley of Or HaTorah Congregation in Los Angeles. I wanted to ask him about the subject of resistance. Is there a parallel in Kabbalistic studies or Jewish mysticism? Here's part, I tape recorded it, of what he said. There is a second self inside you, an inner shadow self. This self doesn't care about you. It doesn't love you. It has its own agenda, and it will kill you. It will kill you like cancer. It will kill you to achieve its agenda, which is to prevent you from actualizing yourself, from becoming who you really are. This shadow self is called, in the Kabbalistic lexicon, the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara, Steve, is what you would call resistance. In the Kabbalistic view of the world, the soul, neshama in Hebrew, is the source of all wisdom and goodness. The neshama seeks constantly to communicate to us, to our consciousness on the physical plane. The soul is trying to guide us, sustain us, restore us. But there is a force operating in opposition to the neshama. This entity, the Yetzer Hara, is a self-sustaining and cunning intelligence.